This podcast is supported by the Freedom From Religion Foundation.
I'm Ron Reagan, an unabashed atheist, and I'm alarmed by the intrusions of religion into our secular government. That's why I'm asking you to join the Freedom From Religion Foundation, the nation's largest and most effective organization of atheists and agnostics, working to keep state and church separate. Phone 1-800-335-4021, 1-800-335-4021, or visit the Freedom From Religion Foundation at ffrf.org. Ron Reagan, lifelong atheist, not afraid of burning in hell.
Hey everyone, it's Estet Herndon, political reporter for the New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way that doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent, I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what the New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to the New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice from the New York Times opinion section. I'm Katie Kingsbury. Last episode, you heard the board interview former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick. In this episode, you'll hear what we had to say after Mr. Patrick walked out the door. If you haven't heard the interview, go back and listen to that first. Joining me today to talk about Mr. Patrick's visit and the candidate's foreign policy positions is Alex Kingsbury.
My name is Alex Kingsbury. I cover issues about technology, politics, foreign policy, and the military.
And no, we're not related. Before we turn to war, let's listen to what the board had to say after the Patrick interview.
I'm still trying to figure out what the central organizing principle of this campaign is.
That was my question.
Slogans are silly, but they're also effective.
If I was, writing his campaign platform, I would basically say, listen, Massachusetts is pretty much the nearest thing we have to the things that Democrats say they want in this country. I helped to implement it. Let me do it for the nation. I think there are problems with that message, and I'm not particularly sure he's making it, but that seems to be the obvious campaign platform for a guy who has his resume.
I actually think that he was trying to make that message, but he just failed, I think. He's kind of a problem solver and a practical guy, and it didn't stand out in any other way.
Yeah, I mean, I've always thought of him, even in Massachusetts, as a very honorable and decent man in an age of unreason. I mean, he's going to be going up against Trump.
He wants to be president of a country that doesn't exist.
We're going to convene
all these people and work with... No. That's not the country today.
He just seemed to float above everything. He just sort of, I wouldn't even call it aloof. It was more just distant and unconnected to the anger and to the... He said he's impatient, that he has hissy fits. And I was looking at this guy and I'm like, you don't seem like someone who has hissy fits or gets impatient.
He certainly did as governor.
All right, fair enough.
There are plenty of examples of him. I mean, I think that the question would be how effective those were.
Did he seem connected to the public's the chord that needed to be struck? That's kind of what I'm missing.
I agree with you that I didn't hear that today. I mean, historically, I've actually never seen a better retail of a politician in my life.
Really?
I think he actually is an extraordinary politician one-on-one. There are a lot of people in Massachusetts who disagree with a lot of his decisions as governor, but they would all tell you they like him as a person. I don't think any of that means you should be president.
I think we're moving to the wrong conclusion here, but just to pause for 1 second. It is the case that he is essentially unique among the candidates in actually having executive experience in government. And one of the things that creates is a record. And that record has a lot of problems in it. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't take those problems seriously, but, part of the reason that we have all of these specific things to talk about with him is that he has actually run something.
Well, you can talk about Bloomberg with him, too.
Yeah,
well,
if Bloomberg chooses to join us, that's fine. But we haven't done that yet.
And to this point,
we've been talking with a bunch of people who get to have ideas and propose bills and have absolutely no record of actually deciding how you run Health and Human Services. And I do think that, that obviously sits around his neck in a race, but it's also the case that he has some tangible accomplishments.
The one question that I didn't get to ask him because I was so infuriated about his Afghanistan response was about the Boston bombings. And, I was there for that. I mean, he was a very sort of cool, under pressure executive making very difficult decisions that have been scrutinized incredibly in the years afterwards. And I know he still stands by them, which is why I sort of didn't ask it. But, if I was campaigning, I would be like, hey, I'm the guy who you know, got through the Boston bombing and made a lot of hard decisions. And
there was just so many things that he had direct experience with, and he didn't mention a single one of them. Like, he could make the strongest case for a public option if he wanted to, because he's been on the ground with that stuff.
But the weird thing is, here we are making a stronger case for him than he made for himself.
Exactly.
And I do think having a sort of a life-altering event like he described is what made him pause for almost a year is really, I could see that sort of permanently altering the way he would approach this, and that he's not. Remember a year and a half ago, his name came up, and there was an eagerness and excitement about it, and then he didn't get in, and people just moved on, and I didn't realize what he was dealing with at the time. But it doesn't surprise me that he hasn't gotten back on the horse. Really, he just doesn't seem there.
Thanks for joining us, Alex.
Happy to be here.
So, Alex, in addition to sharing a last name, you and I both had the pleasure of Deval Patrick as our governor when we were working in Boston. What was your opinion of Deval Patrick when he was governor?
I thought Deval Patrick was a good governor of Massachusetts. He did a lot of good things. He left with pretty high approval ratings. He helped manage the other side of the housing crisis, which was really good, and sort of got the state in a good place. And then there were the management of the Boston Marathon bombings, which was probably, you know, his moment of greatest crisis as a governor.
I thought one of the interesting things from the endorsement interview was the fact that he didn't really make the case that he had a governing record that others didn't have.
Yeah, I was surprised about that, too. I don't even think the Marathon bombing came up, or only in passing. That's such a rare moment for governors, especially, to have such executive experience on their resume. And the fact that Patrick didn't reference it with us was, I thought, a curious omission, just given that that really does separate him from the field in terms of people who can point to, you know, executive national security experience sort of in their own backyard. I mean, Governor Patrick's management of that crisis was not without his critics. I mean, you remember he shut down the entire, you know, Boston metropolitan region. Was a very controversial decision.
I mean, especially because healthcare is such a central point to this election, and the fact that he implemented Romney Care is such a direct example of something that a lot of these presidential candidates are pitching they want to do. It's interesting that he didn't even focus on that. What were your overall impressions of him in the endorsement interview?
My overall impressions of Deval Patrick is that he's a deeply honorable guy in a very dishonorable era. He's a nice guy. He's not a political knife fighter. And so to imagine him going up against Trump is sort of an odd pairing. But listen, he's running on sort of a good news message. What's interesting is that it really hasn't sort of caught on. He has a good resume as an executive and a governor, and polling at zero. So,
yeah, and the governor is such a good retail politician. One of the things I was reminded of as he arrived at the Times for his interview was the fact that he makes a connection with individuals very quickly. That didn't even come through in the interview with us. He seemed a little bit defensive. He seemed a little bit on the back of his heels. He didn't seem prepared.
He didn't seem prepared, and he seems to have, I don't want to say lost a step, but he seems to have lost a bit of the spark that he had when he was governor. And granted, that was a few years ago. But again, you know, these are interviews where a politician comes in and gets one shot at it. So there are going to be politicians who have kind of bad days, or who are not their best, or, you know, who didn't have a cup of coffee. And that's sort of the perils of doing these interviews.
More from our deliberations after a quick break.
This podcast is supported by Tenderfoot TV. Imagine you're a fly on the wall at a dinner between the mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where the new podcast To Die For begins. Hosted by Neil Strauss, To Die For takes listeners inside the dark and dangerous world of Russian sex espionage, where targets are seduced for their secrets and sometimes their lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the producers of To Live and Die in L.A. Binge To Die For now on all podcast platforms.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at The New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at The New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective and, above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to The New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
Welcome back to The Choice.
Sorry, I trampled your question on Afghanistan.
No, sorry I interrupted you, too. It really started to piss me off that he'd said that, and then I was like, I thought about it for a second, and I was like, wait a minute, that's...
Well, just the idea he wouldn't say something because he was a governor, like, that seemed to be what he was saying, but, like...
I mean, as soon as we leave this room, I'm going to go FOIA that and see exactly what he said, because that's an answerable question.
Oh, see, I thought he just made it up. I don't think he thought that there wasn't a plan while he was over there. I think that's after the fact.
That's what I think, yeah.
Yeah.
This is our seventh candidate, and I've yet to meet one who makes me feel like I want them in charge of our foreign policy.
I tend to agree with you, yeah. Actually.
A few interviews into the endorsement process, the Washington Post published the Afghanistan papers, basically demonstrating that the American people had been lied to for years about the prospect of success in Afghanistan. How did that change the questions you wanted to ask the candidates?
I had sort of a variety of military foreign policy questions lined up. And when those stories broke, it was over a couple of days, it seemed just a very clarifying sort of issue that you could raise directly with the candidates. It's one thing for them to say sort of, as they all do, oh, the wars have gone on for too long and we really need to end them. This kind of calls for a deeper reckoning. And it wasn't just that the American people had been lied to by people who were actively sort of saying one thing about the war and knew that it was something different. But there were a lot of people who said and did nothing. And I think that was one of the things that I brought up with Patrick specifically, was raising this issue with him, not of lying so much as silence. And you can't have the situation we had in Afghanistan without a good measure of both.
You probably remember me going pretty hard at him, but this idea that he went to Afghanistan and he knew that there are grave problems and then he didn't say anything was really fascinating to me.
I mean, that is, for me, the story of those Afghan papers. It's that so many people cycled through, could see what was going on, and didn't do anything to change the public narrative, which is that victory was possible.
Right, to raise the alarm in public.
Right.
You asked all of the candidates about Afghanistan and America's military involvements. We also asked them all about Turkey and nuclear weapons, China's democracy, and Israel and Palestine. Was there a right answer we were looking for? And what would the board have wanted to hear from the candidates when it came to foreign policy and military philosophy?
The campaigns have focused so much on domestic issues because that's something that voters say they really care about. And foreign policy always ranks very low in terms of issues that voters say they care about. But I think that is sort of a failure of the framing of foreign policy. We tend to think of it as sort of a, oh, it's just a military issue or it's just this or that. And really, the issues that are animating these campaigns, from global wealth inequality to climate change, international terrorism, and the radicalization abilities of the internet, those are foreign policy issues. And so you hear some of the candidates specifically about climate change. There's sort of a good international consensus kind of peg that they could say about that. In terms of the military stuff, it's harder because they always refuse to answer hypotheticals. So if you say, well, Beijing's going to flood Hong Kong, what would you do about it? That's sort of a trap for any kind of candidate to do that. But to your point, I think we were looking for people who'd thought about these issues in a sort of a substantive way and were able to talk with them to a certain amount of fluency. And I think what really came through for the candidates with a thinner foreign policy resume is that they really couldn't get beyond a lot of the talking points. Like Joe Biden could really dig down on, Turkish policy between the United States and Turkey for 20 years. And Buttigieg as well was very thoughtful about foreign affairs. And it really came through the candidates who sort of didn't think about it or aren't thinking about it in a really nuanced way.
I think one reason to ask about foreign policy is to see how quickly they think on their feet and to see kind of that executive ability, as you describe it, in action. So one of the things that impressed me about the vice president's answer around the question of protests in Hong Kong was that he had like a real answer. He came to it in a concrete way. You could tell he had been in those situations and had to make those kind of fast decision making and knew who the partners to tap were. Others, as you say, their answers were very gauzy. It was something about consistently, well, we would remind China of the importance of human rights. If you have a military escalation of the hypothetical that we were describing, that wasn't very comforting.
It wasn't comforting. And I was sort of struck by how thin a lot of these responses were on foreign affairs. It's one thing for a candidate to be fluent in these in discussing these kinds of issues. It's another thing for them to have the confidence of their convictions that they can tell a general who wants to launch an airstrike no. And I think that's one of the things that's really come through in the Trump administration is that there are moments of international crisis for which decisions need to be made, and the people you surround yourself with is going to help you make those decisions or make sure that those decisions get made in a substantive way. But, you know, the president needs to have the confidence to be able to tell people no. And, you know, too many presidents have sort of acquiesced to what the military wants in a lot of different situations, and that's not an encouraging sign. So I was looking for a lot more confidence on foreign affairs and didn't really see it.
I don't want to say, go as far as today he lied, but he just evaded your question.
100%.
The brother.
I think he might have lied when he said there was nobody. I asked him pointedly. There was nobody else who could
have. He did have a lieutenant governor.
Yeah,
exactly.
Of course he did.
So that can't be true.
The things about the governor's council around commutations and clemency and pardons, there were dozens of cases pending. There's no way if he hadn't pressed the governor's council for more names that they wouldn't have delivered. I mean, I don't know.
One of the advantages we had in interviewing Deval Patrick was the fact that we both had been reporters at the Boston Globe during his tenure as governor. So we knew a lot about the episodes that happened during his gubernatorial terms, and we could ask him direct questions about that. And he paints a much rosier picture than we probably remember from that actual period. I think specifically around the decision to fire the government officials responsible for adding his brother-in-law to a sex offenders registry. He kept insisting he couldn't recuse himself, and he might be right. Massachusetts law is very complicated.
But again, if the path to the nomination has to wind its way through, you know, a dozen provincial scandals from Massachusetts, then your campaign's in kind of a tough spot. You know, I think Deval Patrick wants to be talking about his big ideas and not his granular record on a lot of this stuff that...
But isn't that the most fascinating part about Deval Patrick's campaign, which is that his message of unity is so flat and people are so uninterested in it that we're getting into this nitty-gritty with him? It just really isn't,
anyone. No, I think that's right. He hasn't sort of managed as a campaign to lift his head above water, really, and sort of get noticed and be able to have these conversations on his own terms. So, yeah, I mean, if you're going back through the record, there's only a certain number of sort of things that you return to again and again and again to try and, you know, suss out from him what his larger convictions are and, you know, the way he would operate as president. So it's a tough sell for somebody like that who's going back to the same, you know,
particularly someone who has such a fascinating background coming from Chicago and near poverty, lifting himself up from that, going to Milton Academy, then going to elite universities, having such a distinguished career in the private sector, being elected governor. And yet he's just like so many candidates, actually, that would have once been obvious Democratic candidates for president. He's just not breaking through.
No, he's not. And as I said, he's an honorable guy and he's done some good work in the public interest. And, you know, unfortunately, he just doesn't seem to be the same candidate, you know, the same person he was as governor. You know, he's gotten a little older. The country's changed pretty dramatically in terms of what the vocabulary around political debate is. And he just sort of seems ill-suited to the moment.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
So that's it for Deval Patrick. Tune in to tomorrow's episode to hear Vice President Biden discuss foreign policy, the Hyde Amendment, and those darn millennials. Thanks for listening.
The Choice is produced by At Will Media. Mitch Bluestein, Molly Socha, Ashley Taylor, and Rachel Leitner, with help from Michelle Mason. Mixing by Lauren Gardner and original music by Allison Leighton Brown. Special thanks to Tyson Evans from The New York Times. Our executive producers are Will Malnati from At Will Media and Phoebe Lett from The New York Times. Finally, we want to hear from you. Please rate and review us on the Apple Podcasts app. It'll help more voters find the show.